I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. Hundreds of thousands of marchers were in New York City on Sunday participating in the People's Climate March, campaigning for curbs on carbon emissions. And marchers were drawing attention to this very pressing issue in more than 2,000 locations all over the world. Today at the United Nations, the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the human, environmental, and financial cost of climate change is fast becoming unbearable. No one is immune from climate change, not even these United Nations headquarters, which were flooded during Superstorm Sandy. And the president is giving his remarks now before the UN Assembly. He said, nobody gets a pass. We have to raise our collective ambition. He said the U.S. is doing its part and that it will meet its goal to cut carbon pollution 17% from 2005 levels by 2020. He also announced modest new U.S. commitments to address climate change overseas. So this hour, we'll talk about the global leaders and their climate summit at the United Nations. There is skepticism about what the summit can do, and we'll talk about what it is they can do and what it is they should do before the next real important meeting on this in Paris in December of 2015. We have two guests with us this hour of the program. Later in the show, Frances Moore LePay will join us. Diet for a Small Planet has been her huge international bestseller. She was in New York at the march over the weekend, and we will talk with her. We're going to begin with a guest we've had before, Paul Robbins. Paul Robbins is director of the Nelson Institute at UW-Madison and guides the institute in serving as a world leader in addressing rapid global environmental change. He oversees a growing undergraduate environmental studies program and is establishing a professional master's degree in environmental conservation. He has taught environmental studies, natural resource policy, social theory, and he focuses on the politics surrounding forestry and wildlife conservation in rural India, where he has spent time doing field work, as well as examining the wealth of biodiversity. He's with us the first half of the show. Frances Moore LePay will join us the second part of the program, and we welcome phone calls. We're particularly interested in hearing from some of you, and we did yesterday, a couple of you who had gone to the march in New York City. Our phone number for this hour is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Paul Robbins, thank you for joining us again. Hello.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's talk about the marches that took place all over the world and what that kind of marching does in terms of enacting social change, meaningful change, if any. There were a lot of people in New York on Sunday.
I don't think I remember any kind of mass mobilization like this for the environment in an awfully long time. I mean, in excess of 300,000 people is like the turnout you'd get for the largest marches during the Vietnam era, mm-hmm. civil rights era. It's a lot of people. So something's definitely going on there.
Yeah. And so does it make a difference to the people who are gathering for the UN Assembly, which will look at a number of issues this week, but certainly climate change is one of them? Do they carry that in their minds or hearts somehow as they go into these talks?
Sure. I mean, I think the glass is three quarters full on events like this for decision makers, but there are also limits to what marching alone, accomplishes. So when you move that kind of body power out in the streets, people who are in conversations, and not just in conversations at the UN, but in conversations back sort of behind the scenes with private companies and with NGOs, who there's a lot going on up in New York this week, it gives everybody a shot in the arm. It has a kind of a galvanizing effect for people who want to maintain momentum and conversation. So it's obviously politically very, very valuable for those folks. I mean, with the announcement of the new EPA regulatory structure over the summer, you can really sense probably the administration is quite happy to see a lot of people out in the street.
I would imagine. The president said in his remarks just finished, or he may indeed still be in the middle of the remarks, that the U.S. is doing its part. It will meet its goal to cut carbon pollution 17% from 2005 levels by 2020. Do you believe him?
It all depends on whether those people out in the streets are willing to make some trade-offs, I think, to get there that fast. I mean, for example, the natural gas boom has definitely improved the carbon profile of the United States, whether people like it or not. And I know that fracking associated with natural gas, for example, is distasteful to many people in the environmental community. So you can see that there are some tough choices, but that doesn't mean you couldn't get where you wanted to go if you were willing to think creatively and work collectively.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have pointed to the Copenhagen Agreement calling for this 17% cut by in the year 2005. They made that agreement. Some are saying it's really abysmal that we have made as little progress as we have. Are you disheartened?
So I'm a glass half full environmental scholar.
Yeah.
I think that global climate treaties have shown the limits of their capacity, which doesn't mean we're not going to move forward with one. It doesn't mean that U.S. can't hit commitments. But we know that China and India aren't at the table, something that allows critics to say, oh, well, this isn't going to go anywhere and it doesn't matter. So waiting for everybody's full participation in a Kyoto or Copenhagen type arrangement just may not be realistic. We may be able to act in the absence of something coordinated at the international level. And I also say that there are things going on at community levels all around the country and in cities. Mayors are major leaders on this. I mean, de Blasio just came out and said he's going to bring down, you know, New York City's carbon footprint, something like 80%. You can fact check me, but that seems to be the number that jumps into my mind. And that's a lot. That's a major contribution is what we do in cities. So even in the absence of a Copenhagen-like, Kyoto-like win, I think there are real creative efforts going on at different scales. And I wouldn't want to distract ourselves all the time with the failures of global agreements to take away from the innovations that are occurring all over, including Wisconsin.
I'm sure you saw the op-ed, was it Monday, yesterday, from a professor at Yale, Professor Esty, who talked about what's happening, and you mentioned what's happening in communities, the change really coming, his point is, from governors, mayors, corporate chief executives, and community leaders. He says they are the ones best positioned to make change happen on the ground. We need to move from a top-down strategy to a bottom-up strategy. Would you agree? And if so, how do we do that?
Well, I'd endorse that, 99%. I think that is where we have seen action in the absence of global and national momentum. And some people who are critical of that said, well, if we'd really had federal action and everything would have gone forward, we wouldn't have needed all of that work at the local level. And that's just patently untrue. The innovation is coming from communities. It's coming from mayors because that's where climate rubber hits the road. So that's why you would expect mayors to act where legislators don't. Mayors have to deliver water. They have to get water out of the streets. They have to reduce combined sewer overflows into lakes. So they have such a high stake in this, along with companies and communities, that you would expect them to act long before anybody sitting at the Capitol does. So in that sense, you've got to have it. Now, having said that, does that mean you throw a national conversation out the window? No, you still need that too. So it's not a question of or, but a question kind of and. And I'd also add that in the absence of really touching people where their values are, you know, what they really value, whether that's trout streams in Wisconsin or whatever else, they're not going to get interested in what's happening in New York City. People, I travel around this state, they're not going to get excited about a march in the street in New York. They're going to get much more excited about flooding in their community.
Right. So you're saying then, as we looked at these events and we keep seeing fires in the West and Superstorm Sandy and heat waves where we've seen the hottest year, we probably will have the hottest year on record this year. We've seen flooding and unusual patterns in weather and freezing winters and polar vortexes and all of that, that the response to all of those things that human beings who live there have noticed, that governors have noticed that as well, mayors have noticed that, and they are the ones who are responding to what we're seeing on the ground.
That's it, and it shouldn't be surprising. And enabling them to do it and having a conversation that's as bipartisan or nonpartisan as possible is so much easier when what you're talking about is trout streams instead of talking about climate change, which is, I can tell you, in many communities, a poisonous turn of phrase. I don't know, how we got to this place, but if you keep trying to ram a single agenda down people's throats, they don't respond. But if you ask them, have you Do you know how long the ice was frozen on a lake nearby, if you're an ice fisherman,
yes,
this last year relative to 50 years before? They'll know. They know. People know this stuff. So they'll move on that. They want to see action on that. They want to see their communities protected. So I think that's just an important tactical and strategic way forward to have a conversation that isn't just about climate change, but is about, you know, values and the economy and these kinds of things.
Is it simultaneously important for the nations of the world to set targets, to set timetables for their countries to reduce emissions?
Yes. So that's why I saved a percentage there for national and international action. I think this does have to be a global conversation, whoever leads it, so that we're responding not just to things happening in, you know, Waukesha, but things happening in India, where people who are really on the sharp edge of receiving climate change impacts are really, they're really often very far away from us. They live in island nations in the South Pacific, or they farm in Rajasthan, India, or wherever they live. And if we're not responding to them and working with them through a coordinated treaty, you've got a very uneven, kind of unfair relationship that develops. And that's why the international conversation is, of course, critical.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll take them right off the bat here. Paul Robbins is our first guest. He's director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, author of Political Ecology, A Critical Introduction, and he has experience on the ground doing a lot of field work in India, so he can give us an international perspective. We're talking about this issue. We've talked about it many times. Today, of course, in response to the huge demonstration in New York City and other places, 2,000-some places all over this planet, and also what the president said to the UN today, what the secretary general said, and how the UN will be discussing this issue over this week. We're also looking at what mayors have done, governors have done, what places in Canada have done. We'll talk about that more with our guest. And welcome your phone calls as well. What do you think about the urgency of this issue? Were you in New York over the weekend? Did you demonstrate? Were you surprised by the massive numbers of people who were there from all over the country on Sunday? What does all of that mean? Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Lines are open for you right now, and we start with Victor in West Dallas. Hi, Victor.
Hi. Hey, I'm a semi-hardcore bikist, you know, environmentalist for years and rechargeable bike, but here's my point I want to cross. You know, our technology is too advanced. I've been pushing it for years. That many places in South America, Central America, the Caribbean Islands, the South Pacific Islands, they all could be replaced with electric vehicles. And for years I've been preaching this, but nobody wants to listen. If you're not a celebrity, nobody's going to give you 2 seconds of the time. So what do you think about replacing a lot of these gas-burning vehicles with electric vehicles where it's affordable?
Professor Robbins?
Well, I think any kind of innovation in the transportation sector that changes the overall emissions profile of places around the world is good news. I can tell you, when I first got to Delhi in the late, late 80s? My God. When I first got to Delhi, the air was pretty clean, and within 15 years, you know, it was filthy. And this has caused the government there to really, really innovate. So they moved to an entire fleet of clean natural gas, you know, compressed natural gas vehicles, which, you know, it has made some improvement. You see innovation coming at the pointed end of a stick, getting countries, whichever, if you're talking about Caribbean islands, I don't know, but getting countries or cities to put in and implement new kinds of innovation becomes much easier when they begin to see some bottom line benefits from it. So while I have some sympathy for the argument, I have a lot of sympathy for the argument that no one listens to you unless you're a movie star, I think what's really happening is that decision makers at that scale are listening to technicians and scientists and innovators if those innovations can help the bottom line for those communities. They don't want to do it out of the goodness of their hearts. So I think you're going to see a lot of innovation. My last question about the electric vehicles, about which I know very little, is that they still have to be powered by something. So electricity doesn't come from nowhere, and so one of the key questions is, what is the source of the power generation that produces the electricity? So if you're burning coal to make electricity for electric cars, which is, of course, not what the caller obviously intends, But you could imagine a scenario like that, that you may have a slightly better profile, but you still have a pretty core carboniferous impact. So you have to think through the whole system, too.
Thank you, Victor, for your call. Joe in Green Bay, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Joe.
Great to hear you guys talking about this today. But I'm currently just beginning a program in environmental engineering and wastewater management. And just along those, along that topic, what can you do as a, just a student to even make an impact at your local community? It seems like such a overwhelming feat to get into that it's almost hard to get started sometimes.
That's a great question. We are trying to answer that question here on the Madison campus, but we're not alone. I know lots of folks in Milwaukee and elsewhere in the state are trying to get their students out of their engineering and their environmental programs into places where they can make a difference. Hey, wastewater is a big one. So we're looking at, 20% increase in rainfall by 2050 in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh my.
Coming in 2-inch or greater events in 24 hours. So if you're not managing waste and stormwater, you are going to have filthy lakes and filthy environments. And Milwaukee's been a big leader on this, way ahead of everybody else in the country in terms of preparing their sewage district. I know there are other communities around the state that are working on this, and the quicker we can ramp up internships and opportunities for undergraduates and graduate students who really want to make a difference, these communities will welcome them because they know they got a lot of work to do. So I don't have an easy answer for you, like where to get started, but I know that municipalities are looking for talent. The question is whether they have the resources to use that talent and mobilize it, and I think we need to urge cities and communities to think about underwriting and helping support student innovation and working with those communities in places around this state anyway. I mean, all around the world, really, but we could start here, and I think we're getting a better track record on that. I can speak a little bit to Milwaukee's programs and Madison's, but there are undoubtedly other programs across the state that really could support the stuff you're doing.
Thank you so much, Joe, for your call. In terms of cutting carbon emissions to the extent they need to be cut to make a difference, do you want to prioritize anything? Is there something that needs to be done first, second, third?
Coal. So coal is the big bad guy, and there are lots of people in the coal industry who would argue otherwise, I understand. But when I first met people from American Electric Power, this would have been in the early 90s. These are people who represent the company, a major utility that's heavily coal burning. It exists to the east of us. It's like the Ohio, that whole region that's fed by coal on its power. They said to me, we're ready for the carbon tax because we know it's coming. We know that we've got an industry that has a disproportionate pressure on environmental change, and we're ready to start thinking about it. And the interesting thing is they were getting themselves ready, and nothing ever happened. So this is a good moment to revisit the portfolio, the energy portfolio of the country, and it seems to me that that's one of the places you got to start. It just seems that that's the big one in the room. But there's lots of other interesting places that are related, which would be transportation. Victor brought that up before. You can reimagine transportation at the local and regional level. Many cities are doing it already, and you get a lot of bang for your buck there. And you get a lot of health benefits, as research on this campus has shown, because people are walking and people are on bikes and this kind of thing. That's good for health. It's good for emergency room visits. It's good for obesity. So you get a lot of, let's say climate change isn't even happening, which of course it is, but let's say it wasn't. You'd still get, by dealing with the transportation sector, a much more livable city. You'd get a much better profile. So those are two areas where I think I'd start. I think you got to look at the energy portfolio. Now, the last thing I'll say is, okay, if not coal, then what? And as I hinted earlier, that's a much harder question. We'd all love to see wind and solar, but scaling that immediately may take some, we may need some bridging from some other sources like natural gas. And there are many of my colleagues who make an interesting case for nuclear power, but I don't feel like taking those calls right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Q is next in Madison. Hi, Q.
Hey. I think that 400 demonstrators in New York is great.
It was 400,000.
400,000. But what we need to do is transfer the best U.S. technology to India and China for free, because that's where they need to make the changes most.
Is that true, India and China, Professor?
No question. Your caller's dead right. China's the highest carbon producer right now in the world. Now, remember, on a per capita basis, that's nothing. On a per capita basis, we go through the roof, right, because there's a lot fewer of us in the U.S. than there are in China. But overall, no question, neither of those countries are at the table yet in this U.N. framework, and they need all the help they can get. They are waiting for leadership from outside. But you can be sure, the caller is so dead right on. What we do, what we, quote we, whoever we live in the United States, do matters so much less than what happens in India and China and Africa. Africa is going to electrify. There are places in Africa without electricity. And the population of Africa, before all global population levels off, which it will very soon, 2050, but before that, Africa's going to get bigger. And they want the lights on. So if there isn't technology that's developed to facilitate the aspirations of African people, then it doesn't. Then you're right. 400,000 people in New York City don't really matter. Mm. So thinking globally about this is where the framework is important. Africa is dedicating itself to doing this, and you can be sure they're going to use coal-fired power plants. And there's a reason. They're cheap. It's available, and these people need the lights on. So we need to get realistic about who needs to do what. And I think if Africa is going to be, you know, a heavier and heavier load of carbon in the atmosphere, we need to offset that. Because we have the efficiencies and we have the technology. Bridging that to other countries is equally important, just as the caller suggests. But we need to also be realistic.
And why wouldn't China and India be at the table this week in New York before the UN?
Well, that's a great question. They've been quite hesitant about it. There's many arguments that are made by my colleagues in India, who I know quite well, which is, yes, we're one of the largest producers of carbon now, but if you added the cumulative carbon budget of everything that the United Kingdom and Germany and France and the U.S. has produced since the time of the Industrial Revolution, we have contributed very little. That, in other words, today on a per annum annual basis, yeah, we're big polluters, but look at the legacy in the atmosphere of carbon and other greenhouse gases that the rest of the world has produced. You owe us about 75 years, they would say, which may not be a very compelling argument for us here, but it plays very well at home. And it is true that, you know, the Chinese government wants to move 300 million people into cities in the next 10 or 15 years. So somebody's going to have to put the lights on there, too. These are cities that's equivalent, right, to the 25 biggest cities that already exist today, made from scratch. So they want to innovate, you can be sure, but for the most part, what they're firing up, again, is last year's technology. There's a lot of coal. So they know that they need to follow, but they're not going probably to lead owing to developmental challenges they've got. And that's tricky when you want a global agreement and you haven't got China and India at the table with, you know, billions of people. So I understand the hesitation on the part of the skeptics, but it's really too important to wait.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bruce in Racine. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I heard a report on public radio a couple of days ago that back in my home state of Vermont, the city of Burlington is saying that within the next 10 to 15 years, they expect to be completely free of fossil fuels between using hydro, biomass, solar, wind. And I'm wondering if that is possible on a larger scale. Burlington is a fairly small town of like 40,000. In cities like Milwaukee or Chicago, where you hear stories about existing utilities that are perhaps concerned about funding their current grid and are less inclined to pay premium prices for a buyback of, say, like solar power or wind power, and because they have infrastructures to support. And I'm wondering how that figures into the future.
That's a really great question and could take an hour and a half on its own. Some communities are going to be able to pull off radical changes because they're wealthy, because they're well-positioned relative to, say, hydropower. So the Pacific Northwest, there are communities there who are just better positioned to be able to link themselves in creative ways to energy sources that would green their footprint. Larger cities and larger places are going to have to work from a more practical and complex system of choices. You know, they can't just suddenly throw up windmills everywhere to get Chicago powered. And, in fact, if you did throw up windmills to power Chicago, those windmills would probably be far from Chicago. They'd be somewhere in the plains, the Great Plains. And how do you get all that energy there? You need a grid that drives an enormous power line straight through the state of Wisconsin with all kinds of people, green people, not liking it very much. So when you start to scale up, the politics and the interactions become more complex. And there's also technical challenges for scaling. If we went to solar in Chicago, let's just sort of imagine it, rooftop solar everywhere, you'd still have a problem in terms of shutting on and off those systems under the current grid. You'd really need microgrids or a more distributed grid system. And right now, that just doesn't, that only exists in some places. That's an area, technically, I should add, that the University of Wisconsin works on very, very hard. So it's not that these are impossible steps and aspirations. It just means it's much harder to think about Chicago than Burlington. Mm-hmm. So what Chicago needs to do is look at its portfolio, look at energy demand, look at transportation, look at what their mix is, what they're willing to trade off, and definitely move. They're never going to be, you know, carbon zero, but Chicago could easily move down the carbon ladder very quickly with some pretty low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's my answer. Is elite communities can always make these easy choices. The rest of us have to make harder choices.
Thank you so much, Bruce, for the call. Thank you very much, Paul Robbins, for being with us again.
It's been great fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Paul Robbins, director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, the author of Political Ecology, A Critical Introduction. Francis Moore LePay, who has been active in the environmental movement for a long time, will be joining us momentarily. She was in New York, along with 399,000 other people in the climate demonstration that took place on Sunday. She will be with us and will continue phone calls as we talk about climate change this hour of our program. The UN talking about it this week. The president talked about it within this hour. The secretary general of the UN marched on Sunday and talked about it today as well. What do you think? What will be the outcome of such a massive demonstration? What needs to happen on a local level, on a larger level, on a world level? Do you have any faith that it will happen? Our phone number remaining, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Francis Moore LePay is with us now, author or co-author of 18 books, including Diet for a Small Planet. Her most recent book is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. She's co-founder of Food First and The Small Planet. Diet for a Small Planet has sold over 3 million copies and is considered the blueprint for eating with a small carbon footprint. She's a member of the International Commission on the Future of Food and Agriculture, a founding counselor of the Hamburg-based World Future Council. She has taught all over the world and won many awards. I particularly like this one, the 2013 Humanist of the Year Award from the Boston Ethical Society. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Francis Moore LePay, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I'm bursting after that march.
I'll be-
I want to talk.
Good. So tell me about the march, you and 399,000 other people. That was quite an event. Were you surprised by the huge number?
I confess. And there was a point where we didn't understand why we were standing there an hour and a half after we were supposed to be walking, marching. And then we heard the news that we were blocked because so many people were being added into the march that we that the police were letting in that it couldn't, you know, start. It couldn't move forward. And so that then made me feel better about standing around.
Tell me about the people that you met. It was just such a group of people from all over the country, young people, older people, everything.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting intergenerational aspect was so moving to me. A lot of gray hair and a lot of student age looking and everywhere in between. Mm-hmm. So, and there was a distinct children's section too, which I didn't get to see. I started out in the morning with my daughter speaking to a segment with their own sign. All the different groups had their own signs and slogans, and it was "Cook Organic, Not the Planet." Hmm. That was our T-shirt and sign, you know. And so Anna spoke, and I chimed in, and it was fabulous. It was a little rally while we were waiting. And then we joined the segment for Rainforest Action Network under the, you know, who, the responsible parties for this is the corporations and emphasizing that. And so we marched with Rainforest Action Network because Anna's on the board. And then yesterday I was at a briefing on after it was all over by Rodale Institute about the sequestering of carbon, the critical contribution of organic and regenerative agroecological practices to actually store carbon in the soils. So it was jam-packed.
Well, tell me more about that, storing carbon in the soils.
Well, there are really two pieces that I thought were missing, if I can focus on, you know, my theme songs, which I want to get out there more.
Sure.
I'm sure they were in the march, and certainly Eat Organic, Cook Organic, Not the Planet gets at some of this, but here we are. So we should definitely be focusing on cutting greenhouse gas emissions, and the food system, by one important measure, contributes maybe a third of all the greenhouse gas emissions because it's so heavily reliant on fossil fuel and synthetic fertilizer. So that's important. Equally important is this notion of a cycle, of balancing the cycle, and that means we have to increase the absorption of carbon in the soil, and organic agriculture and what's called agroforestry, the having trees and fields all working together. This is a key piece of increasing sequestration. And so one of the things that I've been so delighted to learn, for example, there was a study in the EU that found that if the entire EU agriculture moved to organic practices, for organic practices, and moved to agroforestry, that is mixing, as I say, trees here and there, you know, in fields, that as much as 37% of current EU greenhouse gas emissions could be sequestered.
Oh, my goodness.
And that, I thought, was incredibly significant. So this is, and there's more research being done. There's no one study that everybody agrees on, but the point is that all these studies are saying that it's very significant and that the way we farm matters enormously, and not just to that organic builds the soil carbon. I use organic and agroecology sort of interchangeably, but it's shifting away from focus on the solution is in purchases and realizing that the solution in agriculture that relates to climate change and ending hunger is the practices. So it's not the new purchases we need, the new whatever magic seed, but new practices that are the new old, you know, building on traditional knowledge of how to build soil carbon and also how to hold water in the soil, because that becomes more and more critical as the planet heats. And clearly, agroecological practices hold more water and therefore more drought resistant. So it's a very, this is a positive part of the climate change message, that some of the solutions actually have multiple goods, multiple benefits for us, as I say, as we move away from thinking purchase, purchase, purchase to how that we can change practices. Then guess what? The poorest, hungriest people, most of them are small farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be our heroes, our climate heroes.
Hmm. Well, we have certainly seen a growth of the organic movement, but simultaneous with that, we keep hearing about this huge growth in very, very large farms, antibiotics being given to animals, perhaps not the kind of concern about what's happening to the earth. Do you see that as a movement that is also growing with the organic movement, and how do you take that on, Francis?
Yeah, it's a race, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure you've heard the term land grabbing. Have you heard
that?
Oh,
sure.
Yes, well, after the big price spikes of the 5 years ago or so, that then the big companies thought, and in some countries thought, oh, we have to grab more land in the global south to grow food because food is scarce, right? And so a lot of land is being taken over, and you're right, more plantation agriculture and more big agrochemical approaches. And at the same time, the most inspiring thing to me right now is I've been really focused on India, where, in some ways, chemical agriculture first entered the global south because that was the place that the quote-unquote Green Revolution was first taken, you know, by these subsidized inputs, meaning pesticides and fertilizers, and you will make it as a farmer. And then, of course, it led to this spiral of indebtedness and depletion of the soil. But guess what? Today, in virtually every state in India, farmers themselves are coming together and learning ecological practices and succeeding brilliantly in getting away from chemicals and saving seeds and sharing seeds. And in many places, there's one state in southern India that has declared the goal of 100% organic agriculture in 10 years. And another near, not too far away, the other side, but southern India, the Ministry of Agriculture is backing farmers who want to move from chemical dependency to organic methods, and they are actually giving stipends to what they call village activists to teach agroecological practices, and it's just moving very fast in rural India.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because it's in line with what we were talking about the first half hour and what I was referencing earlier in the show, the op-ed from Daniel Esty, environmental law and policy professor at Yale, who said that what's really significant, the action on climate change is coming from the bottom up instead of the top down. So we're looking at what governors are doing and mayors are doing and farmers are doing all over the world, perhaps. That is the strategy that we've moved to because people are seeing the effects of climate change. And so they're responding on a smaller level, right? Is that a good thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, but this is massive. Like, I was in India a year and a half ago and meeting women farmers who had just been desperately poor, just heartbreakingly in a semi-famine condition at the time, and have moved to 20 crops in the same field, all organic practices. They are teaching each other seed saving, and they even have their own radio station to promote.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And but I asked them, I said, are you worried about climate change and less rainfall? And they said, you know what? We know what to do. We are saving seeds, know which seeds do well in droughts. And they, as I said, you know, that the soil building qualities of agroecology mean that the soils hold more water. So they are moving forward out of their own need to survive and also, of course, to have meaning and power in their lives. And so people are coming at this from all different motivations, but the point is that the answers are known and that there are answers we can all participate in. And this is the message that has to get out because I fear, and actually I met someone in New York, the only discouraging thing I heard, and I won't mention who it was, but someone who runs a very well-known aggregator website for progressives and told me that when they have climate change in the subject line of their, you know, the headlines of their stories, that they get that readership drops down. And I think I just was so saddened by that. And I think it's that when people feel overwhelmed and there's no place for me and or feel guilty about it, then they don't want to read about it. So I think this very constructive message about the whole cycle, how we can not only reduce emissions but increase the sequestration, and it's good for our bodies and it solves other problems like nitrogen pollution from fertilizer and phosphorus. You know, we heard that horrible story about the pollution in the Great Lakes, and so
yes,
this is something that it moving in this direction solves so many different problems that I've, you know, been worrying about all my life, like world hunger. I mean, it's really a pathway. Can I just tell you one other story?
Of course you can, sure.
Okay, this most Americans have never heard, but this is the win-win-win-win of it. In West Africa, in the country Niger, about 20 years ago, again, absolute desperate, looking at the encroaching desert and fearful and feeling they had to move. And gradually they began to readopt traditional methods, not of planting trees, but allowing the trees to grow that had been there. And the roots, some of the trunks were still there, and they nurtured these back to health. And so it was this regreening, they call it regreening rather than tree planting. And now, guess what? 12.5 million acres, 200 million trees, and food security for about 3 million people. And it's really been each one teach one. It's been farmers sharing their knowledge. And now there's an initiative, agroforestry. This is the approach. They're trying to, in fact, the Dutch government is supporting this, to take this approach of shared knowledge and move it into 15 countries that are threatened by desertification.
Well, you're a voice of optimism you don't very often hear.
And well, I'm a possibilist, you know. I don't call myself an optimist or a pessimist.
A possibilist, that's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah.
It's possible. So, but can I rattle on for another moment?
Sure.
Okay, because I haven't gotten to the punchline yet that I wanted to share. I was thinking about this on the train home because there's another piece that's missing and was really missing to a large degree on Saturday, and that is we hear that climate change is caused by, yes, greenhouse gas emissions, by greedy consumers, by heartless corporations, all those things, yet we need to go beneath all of that and name what it really is, the underlying crisis, in my view, which is it is a crisis of democracy. It's a crisis of faith and confidence in ourselves, in our power as human beings. And I hearken back, you know, 500 years ago, people believed in the divine right of kings, of feudalism. And somehow we hear all these hundreds of years later, and it's like the divine right of wealth somehow, the new feudalism. And I just heard the figure on Friday night at an MIT lecture that 159 people account for 60% of all the super PAC money in so far in this 2014 cycle. And think of it, 159 people with great power to choose who will govern us, who will be making these decisions. And so I just want to say, and I'd love it to hear from people listening, that we can't just blame corporations, or certainly we can't, you know, just blame consumers for not being more proactive, but we also we really have to believe that we can have real democracy and get the power of money out of politics. And there, I see people all over the country stepping up, and we need to turn that into the meta movement, a real democracy movement.
Well, I think we need to bring the women who are farming in India to the UN this week. What do you think?
I agree with that, too. Agree with that, too, because people don't hear their story. And And they said that by coming, this comes back to my theme of a meta movement. The last question to them, you know, that I asked them, well, you know, what is the most important aspect of the work that you're doing together in your sanghas? They meet once a week at 9 o'clock at night, and they said the most important thing is that our group coming together as a group once a week, 9 o'clock, our group gives us courage, courage, and that is the key for me. And that's why I love to tell the story about the Niger farmers or the women in Andhra Pradesh, because we need that courage so that we don't, you know, like I was saying, see the headline about climate change. Oh, we want to click away from it because we don't feel we have the courage to really step up and reclaim democracy. Because if I really believe if citizens could really express their values through our political system, we could turn this around. We can turn this around.
So maybe we need another name, too. I'll ask our audience what they think it might be called. Well, Frances Moore LePay has talked about how she was inspired and how she has inspired many others, of course, by the work that she's been doing for quite some time. She was at the march on Sunday. She, of course, is the author of the huge bestseller, Diet for a Small Planet. She was named as one of 25 people, including Thomas Jefferson, Upton Sinclair, and Julia Child, whose work has changed the way America eats. Her latest book is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Here's our phone number. We have time for a few phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frances Moore LePay is with us for a few more minutes. Let's go to phone calls for her. Dan in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi there, Kathleen and Frances. Thank you so much for doing the show today. I wanted to talk about both local and national and international activities that are possible to deal with climate change. On a local basis, we'll be having a climate march today, this afternoon, here in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, about 4 o'clock until 5. We'll be carrying signs supporting the United Nations Climate Summit here. We have local chapters. We have over a dozen of them in Wisconsin, as you know, Kathleen, of the Citizens Climate Lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're all working for, of course, is a carbon tax or a carbon fee and dividend, whatever language you want to use on it, a way of nationally and internationally getting carbon out of the atmosphere by making it too expensive. A revenue-neutral carbon tax is one that both conservatives and liberals can support, and it is, from what the science is telling us, the only way of getting carbon out of the atmosphere is to make it too expensive to put a price on it. So I'd love to hear Francis's thoughts on that, too.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
First, let me say I love...
Or Dan, sorry.
love Stevens Point. I used to spend a lot of time there.
Oh, you did?
Yeah,
oh,
I did.
Nice.
And I absolutely am with you 100%, and I think what the Citizens Climate Lobby is doing is really out there in front, and I will do everything I can to support that because I think it is a key piece of the puzzle.
And do you think that we need another name? If people are clicking off when they see climate change, what should they be seeing?
I think it's, I'm not, the message in EcoMind, you know, I'm trying to shift the frames into this frame of possibility. And on that score, I think that any way that we express the problem being that we've hit the limits of nature, you know, we've hit the limits of our finite planet is really negative. You know, we're banging against.
Sure.
And so the theme of that book, and I'm not sure there's one word for it, but there is this throughout is, and what the women in Andhra Pradesh are doing and the farmers in Niger are doing is aligning with the laws of nature, and then there is enough for all. And so it's not a question, because if you frame it as we've hit the limits, oh, you bad people, you've got to pull back and do less, then people say, oh, you mean we've hit the limits of nature? We have to go for geoengineering and GMOs. And whereas if you tell them that what we're doing is needlessly breaking, perversely aligning ourselves, if you will, with nature's regenerative power, and actually what the people in Niger and India are doing is aligning with the regeneration that is inherent in natural processes, then we can take a deep breath and realize, yeah, there is enough for all of us and to live more healthfully. So we need to turn this into an opportunity. You know, even if fossil fuels did not burn the, you know, heat up the planet, they have all sorts of other harms for us. So this is a bad idea. So to have gone this way, so really the direction that we're talking about here is the direction of health and ease in life, not this destructive path. And I think that setting it out as that which benefits all of us in terms of, you know, ending hunger and water pollution, all of these different benefits, this is the challenge of our species' opportunity to really step up. And let me just say one thing here is that I really think that it's not a big challenge that kills the human spirit. It's what kills the human spirit is feeling futile and useless.
Sure.
And I think the Citizens Climate Lobby is stepping up and saying we are not, we are not powerless. And the more that this global movement can claim that energy of, yes, people want to have meaning and power in their lives, and here's one way, and connection, too, with others.
Thank you so much. Let's just get a 30-second response from Bill. Bill, can you... I'm sorry, we're running out of time, but give me what you can.
Yeah, 30 seconds. I'll be brief.
Thanks.
I'd like to leave my contact information with you, Kathleen, and I just want to reiterate what Francis was saying about the bottom line, and that's participatory democracy. I've written a book about that, and I'm in the process of starting some democracy clubs. And I'd really kind of like to speak or communicate with Francis about that. And it's true. We're responsible for this. The problem is, how do we overcome and how do we organize to get people to understand that they have a voice? And I think I've done that, and I'd like to speak with Francis about that at some point down the road. So,
all right. Thank you, Bill, very much for the call, and we'll try and figure out a way to make that happen here. Francis, thank you. We're plumb out of time. Thank you for your possibility optimism.
Oh, I love talking to all of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Francis Moore LePay. She was in New York for the big march. She's author or co-author of 18 books, including the one that we all remember, Diet for a Small Planet. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour, and thanks to Scott Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.